Hello, good morning, and welcome. Today we're going to be talking about Calvinism. We've addressed the question of what does it mean to be Protestant? We looked at the life and work of Martin Luther. What does it mean to be Reformed? And we saw that in Switzerland with the German-Swiss and the French-Swiss traditions combining to create what's called the Reformed tradition. And today we're going to go to Holland. We're going to go to the Synod of Dort in Dordrecht. This lesson is about as thick as it gets. So I'm going to go slowly. It is said that good teaching is made up of speaking clearly and endless repetition. So I am going to repeat myself over and over again in a redundant and repetitive fashion by showing you the same information in different ways. Church history is divided into how many quarters? Very good. The first half, from the time of Jesus and the apostles to about the time of the fall of Rome. And last week we looked at Augustine and Pelagius, who 1,200 years later were brought up again as a result of the Synod of Dort. Then the medieval period, which is about 900 years, and then the modern period, the time of the Renaissance and the Reformation, big names we're going to talk about, Calvin, his successor, Theodore Beza in Geneva, and Arminius, Jacobus Arminius, one of the students of Theodore Beza who studied under him in Geneva and then went back to Leiden in Holland. And the postmodern period, which we're not going to talk about at all. So, Calvinism and the Reformed tradition spread from Switzerland to a variety of places throughout Europe, but today we're going to talk about Holland. Last week I introduced the idea of the pendulum of history, that if we swing to one extreme, we tend to want to swing back away from it. And we described this as the length of ladies' skirts over the years. Those of you who are old enough to remember the swinging 60s with mini skirts, before that skirts were longer, after that skirts were longer. And in politics, where we get tired of one party after 4 to 8 years, and we vote in the other party until we get tired of them, and then we swing back. We see an example of this in the 16th century, the 1500s, with the rise of the Reformation, and particularly Calvin and Calvinism was a reaction to Catholicism. Calvin and his successor, Theodore Beza, who was a professor of Greek, there was a reaction against the teachings of Beza because Calvin taught as far as the Bible spoke. When the Bible was silent, he was silent. Theodore Beza did not feel so constrained. So he extrapolated beyond that. There was a reaction against that by a guy named Jacobus Arminius, or James Harmons. And then we had Arminianism in the early 1600s. There was a reaction against Arminianism called the Five Points of Calvinism. So 17th century Calvinism is a reaction to a reaction to the Roman Catholic Church. With me so far? Here's Jacobus Arminius, real name James Harmons, died in 1609. Although he had studied under Beza, did not care for some of the things he taught. He went back and was professor and pastor, professor at the University of Leiden. Very popular pastor. People loved to come and hear him. Popular teacher. He differed with Beza on a number of theological areas. Unconditional election, he had some heartburn over, irresistible grace, the perseverance of saints, and predestination. We'll go into detail on all of those. He had been asked by the administration, look, when you're teaching, because the State Church of Holland is Dutch Reformed, and if you ain't Dutch,
you ain't Dutch.
That's right. The state religion is the Reformed tradition, Calvinism. If you teach, even though you differ, you're not allowed to teach contrary to that. And he said, that's fine, I'll do that. But when he mentored students privately, he would share his opinion and he would share his Arminian perspective. And so when his students would go to be examined to become pastors, they would fail their examinations because they weren't Calvinist. In any event, he was accused of being Pelagian. What does that mean? Well, back in the ancient period of church history, in the late 300s, there was a monk from somewhere in the British Isles, possibly Wales, named Pelagius. Became a popular teacher in Rome, came into conflict with Augustine because Pelagius denied original sin. This is all by way of review from last week. He said, Adam's fall was mythological, and the consequences of that are mythological. There's no such thing as original sin. That the reason you're a sinner is because you sin. Just stop sinning. It's just that simple. Augustine said, no, we sin because we're already sinners. And he popularized the idea of original sin. He was a church father. He was a bishop in Hippo, the northern part of Africa. Today, this would be Algeria. His father was pagan. His mother was a devout Christian, Saint Monica. But his father was a Roman official, kind of a minor Roman official. He grew up very pagan, very lustful, took a concubine when he was 17, had an illegitimate son when he was 18 or 19. He struggled with lust. He studied Manichaeism. He studied literature. He became a Neoplatonist. He moved to Rome and taught rhetoric there, and that's where he came in conflict with Pelagius. He was invited to teach rhetoric to the young emperor who lived in Milan. If you go to Italy today, Milan is the business headquarters of Italy. Not Rome, but Milan. And it's also where I think this week Fashion Week is going on.
And the Olympics.
And the Olympics. So you've got it all. You want to go to Milan? Great gelato. While he was there, he sat under the teaching of Ambrose, known in the Roman Catholic Church as St. Ambrose. If you go to his church, his body is there in the crypt. And Ambrose was a fabulous preacher. And Augustine loved to listen to him. But he had, while he was there, a personal religious conversion by reading a verse out of the book of Romans and was discipled by Ambrose. He writes about his life in his Confessions, and it's one of the first modern biographies. But he writes Confessions as a prayer to God. Fascinating read. He saw the fall of Rome coming. In fact, the barbarians came to the gates of Hippo and besieged the town. As he had seen the fall of Rome earlier, he wrote a book on the city of man and the city of God. City of God is one of his most popular writings. All right, here's what Augustine concluded. He said, before the fall, in the book of Genesis, man had the ability to choose that which is good or choose that which is evil. But after the fall, when man was now liable for death, dead spiritually, And for all of us who are unsaved since that time, we only can choose evil. We do not have the ability to choose that which is good because of the depravity within our heart. Once a person is saved, they become like Adam before the fall. They can choose good. They can choose evil. An illustration of this is found in Mark chapter 7. Would somebody read to us Mark chapter 7, verses 15 and 16, and 20 through 23? This is what Jesus says about our hearts. Yes.
There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him. What was the latter?
And then verses 20 through 23.
What comes out of a person is what defiles him, for from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person.
So, Augustine is echoing the New Testament when he talks about the depravity of our hearts. And this question comes up again with the whole question of Calvinism versus Arminianism. Okay, so a summary of Pelagius versus Augustine. Pelagius denies original sin. Augustine affirms it. Pelagius says man has full ability to choose what is right. Augustine says no, he is not able to choose what is right. Pelagius says grace is good, but it's not really necessary to become saved. And Augustine says, no, it's absolutely essential. On the topic of predestination, Pelagius said, it's based on God looking into the future and seeing that you are going to make a decision for Christ. And based on that, he elects you to salvation. Augustine says, no. John 3:16 says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. It is based on God's foreknowledge. So from Romans 8:29, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son in order that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. And those whom he predestined, he also called. Those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. Remember, Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk. Zwingli studied Augustine very deeply. And Calvin said, when the Roman Catholic Church accused me of inventing new novel things in the church, I could have just answered them by quoting Augustine. So, our learning objectives for today, this was all review from last week. You should be able to differentiate Arminianism from Calvinism. You should be able to trace the causes and the outcomes of the Synod of Dort. And you should be able to discuss the meaning of the 5 points of Calvinism, which we call TULIP. All right. In Europe at this time, in the Reformed tradition, there were what were called the three forms of unity. The first one was the Belgic Confession. These three will be on the final, by the way. The second is the Heidelberg Catechism. Has anybody ever heard of that? Yes, like an hour ago. In fact, I asked them to ask those two questions because it deals with the heart of man. The Heidelberg Catechism, and the third one is the Canons of Dort. So that is what came out of the Synod of Dort. They're called the canons. Let's take a geographical look. Here's Europe. Here's the Belgic Confession, which was written in 1561. Let's jump down to Germany, to Heidelberg. The Heidelberg Catechism. And a catechism is something that is a learning tool that's based on question and answer. Katechismo is the Greek word, and that is a method of learning. The third thing is the Synod of Dort in 1619. That's when the canons of Dort came out. All right, here's the Belgic Confession. It was written in 1561 by Guido de Bray, and between the Netherlands, the lowlands, and Spain, there had been fighting for years because they were under the control of the Spanish crown. And the Spanish crown, which was very Catholic, resented the Reformed Protestant view of the state church of the Netherlands and thought they were all revolutionaries. And so this was written in order to explain to the Spanish king, no, we are not rebels, we're not revolutionaries, we're law-abiding citizens, and these doctrines that we teach are based on the Holy Scripture. But also, it was assumed that the church in Holland was Anabaptist, and no one liked the Anabaptists back then. So the Belgic Confession explained very clearly what they believed and that it wasn't Anabaptist. An example of this is we all believe with the heart and confess with the mouth. This is different than, say, the Nicene Creed, where it says, I believe. The Belgic Confession was written, we believe. It was communal. It was shared. And it was based on a Reformed confession for the church in France, the Huguenots, that was written 2 years earlier by John Calvin. Yay, can't be much more Calvinistic than the Belgic Confession. Number two, the Heidelberg Catechism was written by Zacharias Ursinus. And what's interesting, it was commissioned by Frederick III. You might remember him as the prince who lived in Wittenberg, who built a new university called the University of Wittenberg and had a rock star professor there named Martin Luther. Mm-hmm. And he was the protector of Martin Luther, and Lutheranism and Protestantism were allowed to grow. He wanted to unify the Lutheran view and the Reformed view against the Catholic view. What's interesting about the Heidelberg Catechism, it's divided into 72 Lord's Day lessons. That means you could do one a week every Sunday, and you'd be done by the end of the year. Question?
You said 72, I was
going to say 52. 52 days. And we went through two of the questions this morning during the service. Okay. So, as I said, between the lowlands and Spain, there was this conflict. And sometimes they would fight. And what the Dutch would do is they would lure the Spanish troops into the lowlands below sea level. And they'd break the dikes, flooding the fields so that the Spanish soldiers could not fight. The downside is the seawater would destroy the area from growing anything for years. Here's another little tidbit. Occasionally, England would join in on the side of the Dutch against the Spanish. And the way it worked is this, and this happened particularly during the time of Elizabeth I. The Spanish ships were huge, these huge galleons. And they would have brought gold from the New World. And as they were sailing, especially in the English Channel, these heavy Spanish ships would lie low in the water, But the Dutch and the English had light ships that could maneuver very quickly. And they would take them over and they would split the booty between them, between the English and the Dutch. And the men who did this were called privateers, and later they were known as pirates. Ooh, how exciting. Here's a thought experiment I want you to do. I don't want you to answer. I just want you to think about this question. If Christ died for all, are all saved? Let's talk about Arminianism. Jacobus Arminius died in 1609. His followers, he never really put together a system. He never wrote a system. But his followers put together 5 points where they disagreed with the state church. And they were called remonstrances. A remonstrance is an argument. It means to show something forcefully. First one, God elects or reproves on the foreseen faith or unbelief of an individual. God looks into the future. Number two, Christ died for all men, though only believers are saved. Three, the free will of man is due to only partial depravity, not completely depraved, mostly depraved. Number four, the grace of God can be resisted. And number five, whether or not all who are truly regenerate will certainly persevere requires further investigation. Let me break it down between the Roman Catholic view, the Calvin view, and the Arminian view. On the topic of salvation, the Roman Catholic Church says there's cooperation between God and man, and the church mediates that. So God, man, with the church in the middle. Calvinism says, no, it's all God. Monergism, single worker, and it's God who does the work. Arminianism says, well, there's a gracious cooperation between God and man. What's man's role in salvation? The Roman Catholic Church says man has the moral ability and the spiritual ability to respond to the good news of the gospel. Calvin says, well, there's a moral inability and a spiritual inability. Man is dead, spiritually dead. Dead people don't accept free gifts. One of the analogies that's often used between Arminianism and Calvinism is Arminianism says you fall overboard and you're drowning and somebody throws you a life preserver and all you have to do is reach out and grab that life preserver and you'll be saved. The Calvinistic view says, no, you've fallen overboard, you're dead and you're on the bottom of the ocean. You're not accepting gifts from people throwing life preservers. The only way you're saved is if God rejuvenates you and you are alive again to respond to the faith, with faith to the grace that God has given you. Arminianism says man may not have the moral ability, but he does have the spiritual ability. So here we are at the Synod of Dort. They met 152 times over about 7 months. Wow, that's a lot of meetings. This debate became so severe, there was almost a civil war. And then finally in 1617, the States General, that's the government, voted to have a national synod to address the question of Arminianism. There were 62 Dutch delegates. There were 8 different countries represented, Scotland, Switzerland, Basel, Bern, Zurich, Geneva. There were representatives from Germany, and they even invited some Anglicans from England. We'll get to Anglicanism in 2 weeks. And so they met here, and they had a debate of sorts. Here's how the debate went. So the remonstrants, the followers of Jacobus Arminius, said this. we refute Calvinism. And the States General said, we're not here to talk about Calvinism, we're here to talk about Arminianism. Prove that Arminianism is scripturally true. The Arminians had not prepared for this. They thought that by coming in and saying Calvinism is wrong, especially the topic of double predestination, that people would get all excited and be distracted and talk about how terrible Calvinism is. But that isn't why they were meeting. And so they said, prove that Arminianism is scripturally true. And the Arminians said, no, Calvinism is wrong. And so the States General says, you're dismissed from the Synod. Thank you very much for playing. Come back for double jeopardy when the points can really add up. And went on to develop 5 points against the 5 points of the Remonstrants. With me so far? So they were going to answer the assertions of Arminianism. Then the Remonstrants said, hey, Anglicans from England, can you help us out? And the answer was no. And it concluded with the States General saying, sign the act of cessation, not leaving the United States and becoming the Confederacy. Sign the acts of cessation that you will cease teaching this, which is in error, or you won't be allowed to practice. You won't be allowed to preach. You won't be allowed to teach at the university. And the Remonstrants refused. And so they were sentenced as disturbers of the public peace and were exiled. What's that? So, in review, the Synod of Dort met in Dordrecht, which is sometimes spelled D-O-R-D-T or D-O-R-T. That's the English version of it. They developed the canons of Dort. They rejected the 5 remonstrances. They affirmed Reformed doctrine, and they developed the 5 points of Calvinism, or what we now call TULIP. We didn't call it TULIP until 1905. You think that, well, they called it TULIP because it's Holland, right? And you go to Amsterdam and they have stands where they'll sell tulips. No, that was a much later American thing. All right. What are the canons of Dort? What are the 5 points of Calvinism? By the way, all of these slides and the recording are at billpetra.com/compass. Number 1, God unconditionally elects from the foundations of time some to salvation. Number 2, Christ's atonement was intended to be efficacious only for the elect. Number 3, man is so depraved that divine grace is necessary and sufficient to rejuvenate him and bring him to a point of faith. Number 4, this grace from God cannot be resisted. And number 5, all who are truly regenerate will certainly persevere. Let's look at it in another way. Here's the Arminian position in contrast to the 5 points of Calvinism. Arminianism says it's based on God looking into the future, seeing who will believe, and then he will elect them. Calvinism says, no, it has nothing to do with what you do in your life. It's all by God. Second, Arminians will say Christ died for all, but only some are saved. The Calvinists would argue this. They'd say, then Christ didn't die for anyone. Not effectually, he died potentially for everyone. That's what the Calvinist would say. And in fact, they would say Christ's death is efficient only for the elect. Christ died for all kinds of people, but only the elect are saved. Three, free will because of partial depravity. Calvinists would say, no, grace is required to bring man to faith because he's spiritually dead. Number four, resistible grace. Calvinists would say, no, it's irresistible or it's effective grace. Number five, whether you persevere to the very end of your life with your salvation intact, not so sure. Calvinists would say, yes, perseverance is certain. So, what's man's ability in salvation? Before the fall, he's able to sin, he's able to not sin. Post-fall, he's able to sin, he is unable to not sin. When he's reborn, he's able to sin, he's able to not sin, like Adam before the fall. But when we go to heaven, there will be no presence of sin. We will be able to not sin, and we will be unable to sin. What a glorious day that will be. Okay, we talked about TULIP. This is the modern way of looking at those 5 points. Number one, T, total depravity. That means man is unable to make a decision to affect his salvation. Unconditional election. Who decides? Not man, but God. L, limited atonement, or it's called particular atonement, the atonement for the elect. It is efficient only for the elect. This is usually the one that people have trouble with. Number four, irresistible grace, or irrevocable grace, or surely if God shows grace, you will be saved. And then finally, perseverance of the saints, or sometimes we call it eternal security. Sometimes we call it once saved, always saved. I like perseverance of the saints. What did I do to become saved? Answer, nothing. What can I do to lose my salvation? Answer, nothing. So let's talk about this limited atonement one. There are some people who are 3-point Calvinists. They have trouble with limited atonement and irresistible grace. There are some people who are 4-point Calvinists. They have trouble with limited atonement. There are some people who are 4.5-point Calvinists. Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade, would talk about this. And for most of my life, I wrestled with this question. The second half is this. Did God choose some for salvation? Yes. Did he deliberately choose others for damnation? I couldn't get there. Until 25 years ago, I came to Village 7 Presbyterian Church, and there was a guest speaker named R.C. Sproul. He's a professor, he's a theologian, and he's really good at explaining Reformed theology to regular people like us. And so he spoke for a couple of days, and at the end he says, I'm going to throw it open for a question and answer. I was the first one at the microphone. And I asked this question. Does the Bible teach that God chose some for salvation and chose others for damnation? And he thought for only a moment and he gave me a 4-word answer. And after he had given me that answer, the veil lifted from my eyes, the scales fell from them, the clouds parted, and flaming letters across the sky said, Bill is a 5-point Calvinist. Would you like to know what those 4 words are?
Yes. BillPetro.com.
4 syllables. What he said was, yes, but not symmetrically. Meaning the Bible teaches both, but is louder on God's love and grace in redeeming people than it is on his damning and condemnation. Now, certainly, the good news of Jesus Christ would not be good news without the bad news. And Jesus talks often about damnation and hell and the burning and the worm does not wither and the flame does not go out. Make no mistake about it. But the Bible sounds louder on the first half than it does on the second half. So I had wrestled with this for 30 or 40 years. And I turned to my wife and I said, this is our new church. And I've been here ever since that, 25 years ago. All right, question. Did Calvin teach Calvinism? By which I mean, did Calvin teach the 5 points of Calvinism? That's a question I asked one of my professors. Here's the thing about the 5 points of Calvinism. They were written in reaction to the 5 points that the Remonstrances brought up. When you start an argument, whoever starts the argument sets the agenda. And they had set the agenda on the topic of God's sovereignty in salvation. In theological terms, this is called soteriology, salvation, the study of the Savior. And the 5 points of Calvinism addresses only salvation. Did Calvin teach these 5 points? Yes, no doubt about it. Did he teach these as the most important 5 things? No. Would the Calvinists of Holland have taught these as the 5 most important things of Reformed theology? No. They were addressing the issue of the 5 remonstrances. There's nothing in the 5 points of Calvinism about the Bible, about the Holy Spirit, about the church, all kinds of things that Calvin taught about. It only talks about salvation. So it is not comprehensively all of what Calvin taught. It is a theological response to the debate that was being had. It is not even a summary of Calvin's teachings. All right, so people ask me, Bill, Petro.com, will there be Arminians in heaven? To which I say, yes. Not only that, I believe there will even be Presbyterians. What are some of the big Arminian views throughout history? Let's start in the 1600s. Jacobus Arminius, of course. In England, high church Anglicans that were anti-Puritan. So these would, and we'll get to this in 2 or 3 weeks. During the time of Charles I, he appointed to the Archbishopric of Canterbury a guy named William Laud, who was very much against the Puritans and leaned more toward the Catholics. Now, officially, he wanted to be neither Catholic nor Puritan, but he tended to lean more Catholic. High church Anglicans emphasized tradition, rituals, liturgy, bells and smells, incense, bells, kneeling, genuflection, crossing, etc. Low church Anglicans have kind of a watered-down version of Calvinism. We'll get to that in a few weeks. General Baptist. So that you see the London Baptist statement in the late 1600s. We'll get to them. So that would include Free Will Baptists and today some Southern Baptists. Not all of them, but some. In the 1700s, John Wesley and the Methodists. So John Wesley, his brother started the Holy Club at Oxford. He came in and organized everything. Methodism, especially during the Second Great Awakening, a little bit in the First Great Awakening, but mostly in the Second Great Awakening, was a reform movement for the Anglican Church, and in America was the first church to reach the 1 million mark entirely through evangelism. We'll get to that in a month or so. Charles Finney during the Second Great Awakening. Although he was a 19th century Presbyterian minister, He threw out all his Calvinism and taught that you could manufacture a revival without so much as the help of the Holy Spirit. He's called the father of old revivalism. The holiness movement in the late 1800s, the perfectionism movement, the Church of the Nazarene, Seventh-day Adventist Church, Pentecostalism, so that would be Pentecostal Assemblies of God, charismatic movement. There was a version of the charismatic movement called the evangelistic charismatic movement in the late 1960s out of the Calvary Chapel Church. There was a movie about it called The Jesus Revolution. Yeah. They're charismatic, though you could go to their church for years and never hear anyone speak in tongues. And some 19th and 20th century parachurch organizations and some modern evangelists would hold to the Arminian view. So we've looked at all the different traditions that came out of the Reformation, Lutheranism, the Reform movement from the German Swiss and the French Swiss. They have a Presbyterian form of government, and later we'll see next week the Presbyterian Church, the Swiss Brethren who gave rise to the Anabaptists, and today Arminius gave us the Remonstrant movement or Arminianism. As I mentioned, Methodist, General Baptist, Holiness Pentecostal, and charismatic. In America, in our history, from the Pilgrims coming in 1620 until the end of the American Revolution, the worldview was Calvinistic. It was all about God's will toward man in salvation. Following the American Revolutionary War, America's worldview was increasingly Arminian. It's about how I respond to the gospel that has been given. You see this particularly in the difference between the First Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening. One word summaries as we close. Roman Catholic Church, you are saved by the merit that you merit by observing the seven sacraments by which you might receive the merit from that treasury of merit in the sky that is administrated by the Roman Catholic Church. Luther said justification is by faith alone. Zwingli talked about the sovereignty of God in salvation. The Anabaptists held to credo baptism only, believer's baptism only, not infant baptism. Calvin talked about the omnipotence of God. And you see this throughout the Institutes of the Christian Religion that he wrote. Arminius said man has some ability in the salvation process. And Calvinism of the Dutch Reformed Church held to 5 points of Calvinism. That's it. Any questions before we close? Yes?
I'm wondering, can you give us, Bill, a couple scriptures that Arminians specifically use to refute 5 points of Calvinism?
I could have when I was Arminian.
maybe at BillPetzer.com.
Yeah, maybe someday I'll write an article on it. Yes?
I thought Lisa Anderson last week asked an excellent question. I don't know if you could address that.
Which one?
Why are people like the Church of the Nazarene, I think you mentioned, not to be considered Pelagian heretics?
Okay. Her question I did not answer completely. The Dutch Church ruled that Arminianism, the Remonstrance, was heresy for the Dutch Church. The fact that there are other Arminian traditions elsewhere in the world is fine. But for the Dutch Church, that was considered heresy.
Well, they were either right or wrong.
Who was right or wrong?
The Dutch Church. Because if you call something heresy, That's a pretty serious charge.
Yeah.
So why are not the Church of the Nazarene and other of that ilk?
Well,
not to be considered.
How many Dutch do we have?
Jurisdiction.
Okay, so for you guys, it's heresy. For the rest of you, you're not Dutch. You don't have to worry about it.
And can we compartmentalize it like that?
What do you mean?
For the church, compartmentalize it geographically.
For the church in Holland, it was considered a heresy. But not so when we get to England or Scotland. Well, maybe not so much Scotland.
The question still remains, is it or is it not?
The Synod of Dort was authoritative for the Reformed tradition, but not for the entire church. Now, we've looked at Nicaea. That was for the whole church. That was ecumenical. Churches east and west.
Well, two questions. Does the Catholic Church today believe if you are not part of the Catholic Church, you cannot be saved?
Salvation is only in the church.
Right.
Yeah.
Second
that is
question,
true today.
When TULIP became popularized, or when the Synod of Dort came out with the Protestants of Calvinism, was there a discussion about the fairness of God electing some and not others? Was that sort of a discussion?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. That's kind of the limited atonement question. That is the center of it. Is it fair that God chooses some for damnation, and then do they have a choice? Is that fair? Yeah, that's the eternal question.
I have heard that Americans have the most problem with that fairness idea, that other people from other countries don't see that as a difficulty of understanding of God.
I would agree with that this is particularly American, and that's why today's view in America is Arminian and not Calvinistic for the most part. Yeah. You know, we're a country of individuals. Our Declaration of Independence talks about individual rights. Our Bill of Rights talk about individual rights. Yeah, we would have a hard time with that. Yes?
Just a point of clarity. Should all true believers consider themselves among the elect?
Should all true believers consider themselves part of the elect? Yes. There was another question I missed. And there was some other person that I missed. Was there? Yes, Lisa.
It's not about the Nazarene system. yeah. My question is,
do you know of anyone who's a Nazarene, or did you ever work for someone who was?
Yeah. Can you explain, now maybe you can't today, but just something, I don't know. I'd love to hear it at some point. What unconditional election has to do with what Chris talked about during the infant baptism last week about it's not a guarantee of that baby's salvation, but the parents can expect salvation. And I didn't understand much of what he was talking about. So I made that clear.
Okay.
Or is that just Chris? I mean, let's be
clear. I try to answer questions in less than 2 minutes.
Okay.
Which is why I can't answer your first question. Does circumcision make an 8-day-old boy a believer in God?
No.
So, Zwingli said that infant baptism is like that. We baptize our babies not by their choice. The family and the community of faith chooses to baptize them. Does that make them a believer in God?
No.
And if they're not a believer in God, then they're not saved. But, like the circumcision, which makes them a member of the tribe, makes them a member of the community, and the community will raise them up in the care and admonition of the Lord, infant baptism is like that, in that their parents will, and all of us who raise our hands will help them raise their child so that the child might understand the gospel
and then become saved. So yes, the parents might expect that their child be saved in the future. That is not a guarantee that simply because they're baptized as an infant, they will be. Yes,
so can you tell us what happens to unborn babies that are miscarried or babies that are young and die?
I cannot answer that in less than 2 minutes, and we're over time.
It's a painful question.